Welcome to Baird's Global Investment Banking Podcast. I'm Jeremy Fleiser, Director at Baird, where I'm an investment banker specializing in advising companies in the knowledge solution sectors. Through Baird's podcast series, we intend to share with you perspectives from thought leaders on topics we believe will be relevant to the world we live in today and the world we'll face in the future. Today on our podcast is a continuation in our series on the education sector and the impact that coronavirus is having on it. Our first podcast was on higher education. This is part two in that series, and we'll dive into the K-12 landscape. Similar to the last time, I'm joined today by Chip Green and Vanessa Webb from Oliver Wyman. Chip and Vanessa co-head Oliver Wyman's global education practice. Chip, Vanessa, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We started off talking last time about the state of higher education. Let's do the same and walk through the state of K-12 today. You know, in comparison to other economic cycles, there certainly is a, this time is different in that the vast majority, if not all, of K-12 schools physically closed and moved remote in mid-March through the end of this academic year, which just recently completed for most schools. Walk us through how well you think the K-12 school system was prepared to make the shift to school from home, and how well did schools make that transition?
Maybe I'll start, Jeremy, and I'd say overall, not well. Though in fairness, none of us, and no administrators or teachers anticipated this pandemic. I think, you know, if you think about what were the biggest issues, the lack of one-to-one technology is probably one that comes in right at or near the top. And you had districts who needed to delay start, some by up to a month until every child had a device. You know, in other cases, you had siblings who had to share device and had overlapping homework. Not all families had the needed Wi-Fi. And, you know, while today, if you look in classrooms, and we see this in a lot of our work, most schools and classrooms are using digital materials. But what this pandemic really highlighted is there's still an awful lot of paper. And so, you know, what this meant is as work transitioned home, you had parents printing and uploading, and parents had to become part teacher because unlike digital, which can provide helpful hints and instruction, a worksheet cannot. And so parents had to step in to help. And I think if you looked at a lot of the issues that were occurring, unfortunately, but not surprisingly, many of the biggest challenges affected the lower income kids. So not only were we dealing with a digital divide, but dealing with a related outcomes divide. And, you know, while you saw teachers doing their best and many of them going above and beyond the call of duty and many parents having a huge amount of appreciation for all the teachers do and realizing all parents, including myself, realizing we are not good teachers, these teachers are not trained to teach virtually. And it was not clear that what the right mix of whole group, small group, on your own learning was best. And, you know, in many cases, the individualized in the small group was not possible. And, you know, that's really what you'd have in the classroom. And then you layer on top of that socio-emotional challenges that come alongside a pandemic, kids being home, kids not seeing their friends. And, you know, I haven't seen any data reported on it. I would surmise that you had higher high school kids dropping out of school because it was hard to engage them. So I think, you know, particularly by the end of the school year, but likely throughout, everyone and administrators, teachers, and parents were really in survival mode and hoping to get through to the end of the year. And, you know, while I think everyone got a bit of a pass this year, next year I think the expectations are going to be a lot higher and there's a lot of work to be done over the summer.
Yeah, I mean, you're almost segueing into the next topic that I think is probably on almost every parent with school-age children's mind. What does school look like this fall? I mean, what are you hearing about school in the fall? You know, are we going to be back to school? Will it be some form of online? And what will schools need to do to alter to maintain appropriate social distancing protocol?
Jeremy, that is a very much top of mind question. And I think the administrators running the schools and districts are just now beginning to turn their attention to it. They really don't at this juncture have a clear idea of what the fall will look like. Many of the states have just published guidelines for districts to follow within the last several weeks. The CDC has published some protocols for social distancing, but they're very high level, and the districts really have been left to their own devices to figure out how to implement the various protocols. And there really is no playbook for them to follow. The plans typically, in addition to distant social distancing measures and enhanced cleaning procedures, they're pretty vague. They're open to typically a variety of in-person and online education. That can depend a bit by state, but irrespective of the approach that the schools adopt as their opening strategy, they all require contingency plans if things need to move fully remote or online again due to another outbreak. And given the way that the COVID numbers are trending today, it looks like that's a high probability. The impact is, you can see a wide range of solutions that are being proposed today. I'll just give you a sample of some of the things we've seen. For example, Oklahoma is considering Saturday classes as a way to deal with the social distancing constraints that are going to impose capacity limitations. Other districts are looking at hybrid in-person and remote learning programs, and they take a wide variety of forms. Loudoun County in Virginia is thinking about staggering in-person and virtual at-home schooling, 2 days in classroom, 3 days from home. There are districts in urban Texas that are offering more blended solutions where students are doing a portion of the day at home, a portion of the day in school. Other districts are leaving it up to the parent to decide whether they're comfortable having their child attend classes or whether they prefer that they did another version of the stay-at-home schooling, and it's discretionary. And the in-person offerings that are under consideration are quite varied too. Most classrooms will be probably about 50% full, even when they're running in full session. There's suggestions of taking classes in cohorts or shifts, breaking the day into pieces, the morning cohort, afternoon cohort. And then the logistics of getting to and from school are going to be quite complicated with school buses operating at reduced capacity, and suggestions to stagger arrival times and locations. So it's going to be quite a bit more complex getting things going and ending at the end of the day than typically. And then the other wild card is teachers. There have been a number of studies that have been released recently. USA Today did a survey that found about 20% of teachers say they would be unlikely to go back to school if classrooms reopen in the fall, primarily because of their age and the risk category that they fall in, as most of them were over 50. So there are quite a few unknowns and hurdles that have to be overcome, but I think all of them point to a mix of hoping for in-person but planning for stay-at-home models again.
The one thing I would probably just add to that is these administrators, most of these districts, I think they don't know yet. They have been focused on getting through and surviving this school year, and I think for most of them, and this sort of come up in a few conversations that I've had with superintendents, that they're going to finish the year, they're probably going to take a week or two off, and then they're really going to focus on this. But I think in some of the conversation I've been involved in, I've been surprised at how few districts have concrete plans. And I think it's because all of this is evolving, but I think it's also because they are so busy just trying to get through the school year.
Chip hit on some at your point. It sounds like there won't be kind of a uniform solution across the country. And frankly, maybe even within the same states, you may see different school districts, running different protocols this upcoming school year. Is that fair?
Absolutely. You know, there's 14,000 districts. I don't think we're going to have 14,000 different plants, but I think there's probably going to be 15 to 20 models that, that people launch with. And if we go into the spring of 21 after the holidays and we still don't have herd immunity or a vaccination in sight, I think there'll be a lot of sharing and revisions because there'll be a lot of lessons learned in the fall as people try the various approaches.
Vanessa, to go back to a topic you talked about at the onset, is how COVID-19 has further exposed the digital divide in our schools. Maybe to put some numbers around that, according to the most recent data, about 14% of households with school-aged children do not have internet access, which translates into approximately 9 million students. And then among children 3 through 18, 17% live in households without a laptop or a desktop computer. So at least 11 million students don't have a computer for online learning at all, in addition to those that may be needing to share a single device with siblings throughout the day. So let's talk a little bit more about the digital divide. Why is it such an important issue, and how do you believe schools will need to react to attempt to address this post-COVID-19?
It's a good question, and if you think about the education sector, it's behind pretty much every single sector from a technology perspective. And we've just been slower to adopt. And in most sector, you implement technology, you save costs on labor as a result, and you have the cost savings to reinvest into more better technology. So it enhances productivity. In education, this is not the case, as technology is additive. It's not replacing teachers. So there's not been the same economic impetus and really forcing function to get it into these schools and to move and achieve one-to-one technology. And, you know, there have been a couple points of acceleration over the past 20 years. And we've been talking about the, you know, digital, you know, and full digital transformation is right around the corner for 20 years. And, you know, the first big one was during the past decade, where many of the summative assessments, the end of year assessments, went online. And as a result, you really had to have more tablets and devices in schools so the kids could practice and get used to using computers. And as a result, they used them for other elements of their day at school. You know, for me, this could be the second acceleration. And, you know, the reason being is that, you know, as you talked about, Jeremy, I mean, there is a huge divide in their very basic necessities, computers and internet, to be able to operate in a hybrid environment, which we may be in the fall, in an environment where kids are at home for a month because there's an outbreak. And it's, these schools are going to have to figure it out. You know, if they think about some of the markets in technology, like the online assessments or ebooks or supplemental digital, and what do I think is going to happen to those markets? Budgets are going to be tight. Are those markets going to go down? And I can't see a scenario, and this may be contrarian, but I can't see a scenario where they're not going up, because these districts are going to need to operate, and they're going to have to catch up in terms of the learnings and the outcomes next year, and particularly the ones that were slower to get going and the ones where the kids were not able to get the full curriculum this year. And that is, by and large, more so occurred in the lower income, in the lower income neighborhoods and schools and districts. And so, as a result, I think we're going to see, despite tighter budgets, a real push towards getting devices, helping with internet, and we're going to see a lot more, you know, assessments. Let's figure out where the kids are and where they're deficient and where they need help, because the teachers are not going to be spending as much time with them. Let's get the ebooks in their hand and the reading comprehension. So if they go home and they don't have the books, they can keep learning and the like. So, you know, I think it's a real issue, and if it doesn't get solved this year, we're going to have some massive issues in this country, particularly in the lower income areas. But I also think that the districts are going to make digital and digital enhancements a real priority this summer and a real priority for how they spend their budget.
You talked a little bit about learning outcomes, which is a good transition to our next point. Most states canceled their summative end of year assessments. In addition, there definitely was varying degrees of efficacy of learning from home for the last kind of 3 to 4 months. You know, we always talk about the summer slide where students can lose upwards of 20-25% of knowledge gain in the prior academic year just over the course of the summer. And that slide this year is likely compounded with some level of the quote-unquote spring slide. So how do you believe schools will make up for that lost knowledge this year? And how will schools really even know where their students are in terms of their learning progression when school resumes?
It really is a daunting challenge. And all of the work that we've done said that the attendance and engagement this spring was quite low. So there really wasn't widespread learning going on. And as Vanessa noted, the disadvantaged children were hit particularly hard. I think the net effect is that most children return to school ready to pick up where they were sometime around Thanksgiving or the end of the calendar year last year. So there's a lot of ground that needs to be made up, and there will be a lot of variability in where students are beginning the year. I think that the likely response will be to focus on the basics. They'll focus instruction time on reading, writing, arithmetic, and science, particularly for the early years, where reading and writing and arithmetic are very much fundamental to learning the more sophisticated concepts they'll encounter in the later years. And I think that the challenge is meeting each child where they are, which means you first have to understand where they're starting from. So I think we're likely to see a lot more use of benchmark interim assessments, which will provide a foundational diagnostic of where each child is at the outset of the school year. And those will likely be administered several times throughout the school year to keep tabs on how people are progressing and what each child needs to do to get caught up and back up to speed. There are also supplemental instructional materials that I think will aid in that process. They're very tailored. They're systems that have diagnostics and then instruction based on the results of the diagnostics for each student. So it becomes much more of an individualized approach, because we're not starting with every child, presumably at the same ending point from the prior school year. And I think the curriculum products that will be used, the supplemental products, are likely to be digital, so they can port over in case we do go to school at home again.
Let's talk about the big picture. No doubt public school budgets will be challenged in the upcoming years due to the macroeconomic environment. There will be a likely scenario of a combination of decreased funding due to tax revenue challenges, as well as potential increased costs associated with safely reopening schools. California, for example, has proposed a 10% cut to the state's main K-12 school fund. So what are you currently hearing in terms of potential decreases in annual school operating budgets? And further, and same question we walked through during our higher ed podcast, in light of these budget challenges, what types of third-party solutions sold in the K-12 might be thought of as quote-unquote winners, and which solutions will see challenges going forward?
Most districts, when you talk to them, and there's some surveys out there, do think that their budgets will be hit in the upcoming year. And so it's really going to be about prioritization and how they move line items around in their budgets. And, as I talked about earlier, from our perspective, the digital elements that are supporting curriculum are going to be a key priority. So the devices, I think as Chip talked about, the supplemental materials, the e-books that link directly to reading comprehension, because these can be used at home. It can personalize the learning. The kids can go at their own pace. You don't need as much parent intervention. You're now seeing LMSs, and this came in the spring for the lower grades, and LMSs have typically not been used as much, particularly paid LMSs for kindergarten and the early elementary years, but they become more important in this environment. Things like the high school credit recovery and the online courses are likely to get a lot more uses, and there's likely to be more of a need, as there will be courses from this year that won't, that weren't finished, and kids are going to need to go back and repeat them. And I think, you know, as you think about where's the money going to come from, I think from a curriculum standpoint, while it hasn't, we haven't seen announcements on this yet, I think there's a really high likelihood that, that textbook adoptions will be delayed. It's just really hard to see states in this economic environment and in this pandemic environment going through textbook adoptions where the district has to have a lot of meetings. They typically do a lot of these evaluations and they like to in person. The state has to set aside a one-time large chunk of money for paper. And so it's more likely to see that these dollars get shifted to digital supplements, to do what many districts are already doing today, more do-it-yourself curriculum where you're bringing together different different pieces of instructional materials. And I also think what you may see is with a lot of states that they request waivers and they don't do summative assessments this year. And that also creates savings that can be reinvested in other parts of the learning curriculum. And, you know, putting curriculum aside, there are likely also other tools around the school website, school messenger, school safety, where digital communication with parents in this environment becomes a lot more important. Mental health, both software and services dealing with the socio-emotional, the mental health of the kids becomes more important. Things like automatic doors. School buses, as Chip alluded to earlier, you're either gonna need more buses or you're gonna need the buses to run more routes. So there are a lot of pieces that become more of a need, and so as a result, that there are gonna be sectors and subsegments from a market perspective in K-12 that are the ones that are more nice to have versus the need to have that are going to fall to the bottom of the list and likely struggle more in this environment.
Chip, Vanessa, a final question. Vanessa, you talked about how funding lags the cycle. So what does history from past recessions tell us about how school budgets might be challenged versus timing to return to pre-downturn levels?
The funding for schools is predominantly from state and local tax bases. The local tax base supports about 40 to 50% of the annual operating budget. State comes in about another 40, 45%, and then the balance somewhere between 5 and 10% typically is provided by the federal government. One of the unique aspects of finance here is that municipalities and states can't finance operating debts. They have to run balanced budgets. And that, as you pointed out, in the last recession led the federal government to step in and offset some of the reductions in the local and state tax base to keep things going. The first impact that schools feel on their revenue sources is the state income tax base, which is the primary funder that the state uses. There's some property tax in there, but it's primarily income tax and sales tax. So both of those drop as soon as the economy slows down, people stop spending and lose jobs. The local tax base is predominantly property taxes. While those may decline, they are typically reappraised on a three-year cycle. So one-third of the property is reappraised each year. And it takes time for that. If there are impacts to property tax values, the impact is spread in over 3 years. So that's where the lag effect tends to come. In the last couple, for the last recession, it was a housing-led recession. So there was a prolonged downturn as property values declined. They were reassessed at lower rates, and there was less funding available from municipalities. The state and the federal portion made up for the decline. The state rebounded relatively quickly and moves with the economic recovery. So the built-in lag comes from the property value impact on the local tax receipts. this one's a little hard to see exactly how it's going to play out. We seem to be on the upswing now, but if the outbreaks that we're seeing lead to another restriction on activity, I think we're going to find that this one could be drug out for quite a while. And rather than having a U-shaped recovery, we end up with something that looks like more like a Nike swoosh, which would take several years to get the tax base back to where it was pre-COVID. So it could be prolonged downturn. I expect this is an election year. I would expect that the federal government is going to step in. The schools have high fixed cost base, approximately 75% to 85%, depending on the district. Cost base is in administration and faculty. So if you need to preserve teachers, you don't have a lot of operating discretionary expenses that you can cut in the downturn.
That concludes our podcast today. Vanessa, Chip, thank you very much for the time today and the insights that you provided in both of our podcasts.
Thanks very much for having us, Jeremy.
Robert W. Baird & Company Incorporated is a member of the SBIC. Robert Baird Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For more information, go to rwbaird.com.